Hello. This is the Pearson EdExcel International GCSE English as a Second Language, Paper 2R Listening Test, Summer 2016. This test is in three parts. You will hear three extracts and will have to answer questions on what you hear. At the beginning of each extract, there will be a pause to give you time to read the questions. You will hear all three parts twice. Write your answers in the spaces in your question booklet as you listen. Part 1. In this part, you will hear the principal of a school talking about prize day. Listen and complete the notes. Write no more than three words for each answer. One mark will be awarded for each completed answer. First, you have 1 minute to read the questions. Now listen and answer the questions.
Good morning, everyone. I'd like to talk to you today about Prize Day, which will be held at the end of term. I'm sure many of you would like to know how we award prizes. The first thing to understand is that we consider all students in the school when making our decisions. You may be considered for your class prize or a subject prize. We also have a range of additional prizes, and it's these I'd like to explain further. There are the annual prizes for anyone who achieves 100% attendance during the course of the entire year. This may seem easy enough, but you'd be surprised how few of them we give out each year. Also, one person in each year group will be considered for the prize for the most improved student. This is awarded to anyone who, in the estimation of their teachers, has made an extra special effort with their studies. In addition, trophies are awarded to students for their achievements in certain areas. Our school has a well-deserved reputation for the quality of our language teaching, and we offer a silver cup in oral Spanish. Another department which offers special awards is the technology department, with a prize in junior and senior technology. This year, we'll be awarding a brand new trophy. This is the Rutherford Star for the school's most outstanding senior actor. As you know, Mike Rutherford is a household name due to his starring role in the weekly TV programme The Detectives. He's an old boy of the school and has graciously donated this award in memory of his time here. He'll be with us on Prize Day to make the presentation. Other departments which will be awarding special prizes include music and art. Extracurricular prizes are available for the debating, public speaking, chess and astronomy societies. The Eco-Carer Award is for contribution to the environment. And the Chubb Family Trophy is for the person who has made the greatest contribution to raising money or devoting time to their charity of choice. In addition, there's an award for home economics. Of course, sporting achievements will be recognised on Prize Day, and there'll be medals for football, cricket and netball, as well as ones for each year group for sporting excellence. Other team sports will be recognised as well. Some details about the prizes. In the past, subject and class prizes were in the form of cash, but from now on we're giving out book tokens. For cups, trophies and sports medals, the amount will vary, but they will continue to be cash prizes. I think I should say here that the arrangements for Prize Day have changed. In the past, the ceremony has been held in the main hall of the school. However, for the first time, we're using a different location. The Great Hall of the University on Park Street. We're really excited by this new development. The event will be held on Friday the 16th of December, commencing at 10:30. This means that you will not go to school on that morning, but will meet your form tutor outside the building no later than 9:45. You'll be free to enjoy a half-day holiday after the event, from approximately 12:30 onwards. All parents are cordially invited to attend. There will be a number of speakers and presenters of prizes. This opportunity to have Prize Day at the university is due, for the most part, to the efforts of one person, Professor Morgan of the Chemistry Department. And in recognition of all that she's done for the school, we're pleased to announce that she'll be the guest of honour at this year's ceremony. Please do not forget that this is a compulsory event and you must all attend. You will need to make your own arrangements for arriving at and being collected from the ceremony. Those of you who come to school by coach will have to make your own transport arrangements, as none of the coach companies will deliver you to or pick you up from the venue. The dress code for Prize Day is formal uniform, but without hats. Should it be cold on the day, plain white t-shirts or vests may be worn under school shirts. One final thing, bags are not to be brought on the day, as there are no facilities for storage at the university.
Now listen a second time and check your answers.
Good morning, everyone. I'd like to talk to you today about Prize Day, which will be held at the end of term. I'm sure many of you would like to know how we award prizes. The first thing to understand is that we consider all students in the school when making our decisions. You may be considered for your class prize or a subject prize. We also have a range of additional prizes, and it's these I'd like to explain further. There are the annual prizes for anyone who achieves 100% attendance during the course of the entire year. This may seem easy enough, but you'd be surprised how few of them we give out each year. Also, one person in each year group will be considered for the prize for the most improved student. This is awarded to anyone who, in the estimation of their teachers, has made an extra special effort with their studies. In addition, trophies are awarded to students for their achievements in certain areas. Our school has a well-deserved reputation for the quality of our language teaching, and we offer a silver cup in oral Spanish. Another department which offers special awards is the technology department, with a prize in junior and senior technology. This year, we'll be awarding a brand new trophy. This is the Rutherford Star for the school's most outstanding senior actor. As you know, Mike Rutherford is a household name due to his starring role in the weekly TV programme, The Detectives. He's an old boy of the school and has graciously donated this award in memory of his time here. He'll be with us on Prize Day to make the presentation. Other departments which will be awarding special prizes include music and art. Extracurricular prizes are available for the debating, public speaking, chess and astronomy societies. The Eco-Carer Award is for contribution to the environment. And the Chubb Family Trophy is for the person who has made the greatest contribution to raising money or devoting time to their charity of choice. In addition, there's an award for home economics. Of course, sporting achievements will be recognised on Prize Day, and there'll be medals for football, cricket and netball, as well as ones for each year group for sporting excellence. Other team sports will be recognised as well. Some details about the prizes. In the past, subject and class prizes were in the form of cash, but from now on we're giving out book tokens. For cups, trophies and sports medals, the amount will vary, but they will continue to be cash prizes. I think I should say here that the arrangements for Prize Day have changed. In the past, the ceremony has been held in the main hall of the school. However, for the first time, we're using a different location. The Great Hall of the University on Park Street. We're really excited by this new development. The event will be held on Friday the 16th of December, commencing at 10:30. This means that you will not go to school on that morning, but will meet your form tutor outside the building no later than 9:45. You'll be free to enjoy a half-day holiday after the event, from approximately 12:30 onwards. All parents are cordially invited to attend. There will be a number of speakers and presenters of prizes. This opportunity to have Prize Day at the university is due, for the most part, to the efforts of one person, Professor Morgan of the Chemistry Department. And in recognition of all that she's done for the school, we're pleased to announce that she'll be the guest of honour at this year's ceremony. Please do not forget that this is a compulsory event and you must all attend. You will need to make your own arrangements for arriving at and being collected from the ceremony. Those of you who come to school by coach will have to make your own transport arrangements, as none of the coach companies will deliver you to or pick you up from the venue. The dress code for Prize Day is formal uniform, but without hats. Should it be cold on the day, plain white t-shirts or vests may be worn under school shirts. One final thing, bags are not to be brought on the day, as there are no facilities for storage at the university.
That's the end of part one. Now turn to part two.
Part two. In this part, you will hear an interview with an Indian wildlife biologist. Listen and answer the questions. Write no more than three words for each answer. One mark will be awarded for each answer. First, you have 1 minute to read the questions. Now listen and answer the questions.
Hello. In the studio today, we have wildlife biologist Raj Kumar, who's going to talk about his life and work. Welcome, Raj.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
I've always been interested in the job of a wildlife biologist. Could you tell me something about what your work involves?
I'm basically a consultant and a nature educator. As a consultant, I'm sometimes hired by international organizations or the Indian Forestry Department to carry out research on the population of a particular species or its habitat. Recently, I've started working with a number of schools as an outdoor educator, introducing children to nature and letting them experience it firsthand. I tend to enjoy this more than research and find it more meaningful from a conservation point of view. But fieldwork really is the fun part of a wildlife biologist's work and is something I don't think I'll ever tire of. Everything. The birds and other wildlife, walking through the forest, the fresh air, the silence, and the stars at night. It's just magical.
How did your interest in wildlife come about?
Well, it started when I was very young. I spent many of my school holidays on a tea estate in northern India and used to go fishing and walking with my uncle. My sister would read me books by famous wildlife authors such as Gerald Durrell. My mother and sister would spend many hours birdwatching. They were so engrossed by this, and I would often go with them. I think their enthusiasm for the hobby rubbed off on me. In fact, I ended up writing a book myself on the birds of the Himalayas, which was published last year.
Could you tell us how you can become a wildlife professional?
There are several avenues that are now open. First, you need a degree in life sciences. If you want to carry out wildlife research, there are several postgraduate courses on offer. You can apply for work as a guide in nature reserves, and this is where the bulk of graduates find work. Also, many resorts and tourist companies are constantly on the lookout for suitably qualified staff. Others are employed by international organizations.
You did your postgraduate studies at the Wildlife Institute of India. Could you tell us of your experiences there?
I did a master's degree there, which prepared me well for a career in wildlife research and conservation. We had access to the country's forests, and this was a huge advantage. The Institute also runs diploma courses in wildlife management for Forest Service personnel, and this allows students to interact with people who are working directly on conservation and wildlife management issues. This helps bridge the gap between researchers and people on the ground.
I recently read your article about tigers in India. Could you tell us more about these animals?
They're not doing so badly in India, at least in most places. Thanks to high-profile media campaigns to protect the tiger, reserves are coming under pressure to step up patrolling and anti-poaching measures. As long as these measures are sustained, tigers will survive. The next step is to look beyond tiger reserves at areas of the country such as the Himalayas, where isolated populations must be connected through the establishment of forest corridors, which will be crucial in maintaining genetic variability and ensuring the long-term future of these animals in India.
How many tigers are there left in India?
Well, no method of counting wildlife is entirely accurate, and the short answer is that we don't really know for sure. In any event, we should really talk in terms of population estimates rather than exact numbers. We used to base these numbers on counting tiger footprints, which was highly inaccurate. But the method involving camera traps that we use today is as accurate a one as we are ever going to get.
What are your views on the state of the zoos in this country?
I visited all of them, and with one or two exceptions, there's a lot of work that needs to be done. We're still using an old-fashioned method of keeping animals. They should be in environments that are similar to their natural environment, not in cages with little stimulation. Some zoos have schemes where they're trying to breed captive animals and increase the population. But they are at best unscientific. Also, the educational facilities at many zoos are poor or inadequate.
Many international tourists come to India to visit our national parks and see our wildlife. Do you think this has been a success story?
National parks were set up to conserve certain habitats and their wildlife. This was their primary mission. But it seems that tourism has overshadowed this aim. Tour operators treat national parks as a way to make money from visitors. They pack them off in vehicles so that they can take pictures of wildlife. They build resorts on the edges of parks to encourage visitors. And although they say they are eco-friendly, they are bright, busy, noisy places with such inappropriate things as dance floors. I can't believe how far away they are from the eco-friendly wildlife experience they advertise in the brochure.
What is the resulting effect on the wildlife?
It is badly disturbed by all this attention. And that's not all. The litter generated by the visitors is polluting some of our pristine landscapes. We need to protect them more. I would even go as far as suggesting that tourism should be stopped in national parks and large safari parks be developed that are well stocked with tigers and other large animals, where tourists can be driven through to see these creatures and take pictures of them. This would allow wildlife elsewhere to remain undisturbed.
Just before we finish, can I ask what you think of the Adopt an Animal initiative recently started at one zoo?
The idea behind this is to get celebrities to adopt an animal in a zoo in order to attract the public's attention to zoos and to show others how concerned they are about animal conservation. It certainly doesn't help the animals, though. It's rubbish, to my mind. It's good publicity for the stars, but the animals remain in pitiable conditions.
Raj Kumar, thank you for coming into the studio today.
Now listen a second time and check your answers.
Hello. In the studio today, we have wildlife biologist Raj Kumar, who's going to talk about his life and work. Welcome, Raj.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
I've always been interested in the job of a wildlife biologist. Could you tell me something about what your work involves?
I'm basically a consultant and a nature educator. As a consultant, I'm sometimes hired by international organisations or the Indian Forestry Department to carry out research on the population of a particular species or its habitat. Recently, I've started working with a number of schools as an outdoor educator, introducing children to nature and letting them experience it firsthand. I tend to enjoy this more than research and find it more meaningful from a conservation point of view. But fieldwork really is the fun part of a wildlife biologist's work, and is something I don't think I'll ever tire of. Everything. The birds and other wildlife, walking through the forest, the fresh air, the silence, and the stars at night. It's just magical.
How did your interest in wildlife come about?
Well, it started when I was very young. I spent many of my school holidays on a tea estate in northern India and used to go fishing and walking with my uncle. My sister would read me books by famous wildlife authors, such as Gerald Durrell. My mother and sister would spend many hours birdwatching. They were so engrossed by this, and I would often go with them. I think their enthusiasm for the hobby rubbed off on me. In fact, I ended up writing a book myself on the birds of the Himalayas, which was published last year.
Could you tell us how you can become a wildlife professional?
There are several avenues that are now open. First, you need a degree in life sciences. If you want to carry out wildlife research, there are several postgraduate courses on offer. You can apply for work as a guide in nature reserves, and this is where the bulk of graduates find work. Also, many resorts and tourist companies are constantly on the lookout for suitably qualified staff. Others are employed by international organisations.
You did your postgraduate studies at the Wildlife Institute of India. Could you tell us of your experiences there?
I did a master's degree there, which prepared me well for a career in wildlife research and conservation. We had access to the country's forests, and this was a huge advantage. The Institute also runs diploma courses in wildlife management for Forest Service personnel, and this allows students to interact with people who are working directly on conservation and wildlife management issues. This helps bridge the gap between researchers and people on the ground.
I recently read your article about tigers in India. Could you tell us more about these animals?
They're not doing so badly in India, at least in most places. Thanks to high-profile media campaigns to protect the tiger, reserves are coming under pressure to step up patrolling and anti-poaching measures. As long as these measures are sustained, tigers will survive. The next step is to look beyond tiger reserves at areas of the country such as the Himalayas, where isolated populations must be connected through the establishment of forest corridors, which will be crucial in maintaining genetic variability and ensuring the long-term future of these animals in India.
How many tigers are there left in India?
Well, no method of counting wildlife is entirely accurate, and the short answer is that we don't really know for sure. In any event, we should really talk in terms of population estimates rather than exact numbers. We used to base these numbers on counting tiger footprints, which was highly inaccurate. But the method involving camera traps that we use today is as accurate a one as we are ever going to get.
What are your views on the state of the zoos in this country?
I visited all of them, and with one or two exceptions, there's a lot of work that needs to be done. We're still using an old-fashioned method of keeping animals. They should be in environments that are similar to their natural environment, not in cages with little stimulation. Some zoos have schemes where they're trying to breed captive animals and increase the population, but they are at best unscientific. Also, the educational facilities at many zoos are poor or inadequate.
Many international tourists come to India to visit our national parks and see our wildlife. Do you think this has been a success story?
National parks were set up to conserve certain habitats and their wildlife. This was their primary mission. But it seems that tourism has overshadowed this aim. Tour operators treat national parks as a way to make money from visitors. They pack them off in vehicles so that they can take pictures of wildlife. They build resorts on the edges of parks to encourage visitors. And although they say they are eco-friendly, they are bright, busy, noisy places with such inappropriate things as dance floors. I can't believe how far away they are from the eco-friendly wildlife experience they advertise in the brochure.
What is the resulting effect on the wildlife?
It is badly disturbed by all this attention. And that's not all. The litter generated by the visitors is polluting some of our pristine landscapes. We need to protect them more. I would even go as far as suggesting that tourism should be stopped in national parks, and large safari parks be developed that are well stocked with tigers and other large animals, where tourists can be driven through to see these creatures and take pictures of them. This would allow wildlife elsewhere to remain undisturbed.
Just before we finish, can I ask what you think of the Adopt an Animal initiative recently started at one zoo?
The idea behind this is to get celebrities to adopt an animal in a zoo in order to attract the public's attention to zoos and to show others how concerned they are about animal conservation. It certainly doesn't help the animals, though. It's rubbish, to my mind. It's good publicity for the stars, but the animals remain in pitiable conditions.
Raj Kumar, thank you for coming into the studio today.
That's the end of part two. Now turn to part three.
Part three. In this part, you will hear an extract from a radio program on the history of timekeeping. Listen and complete the sentences. Write no more than three words for each answer. One mark will be awarded for each completed sentence. First, you have 1 minute to read the questions. Now listen and answer the questions.
At least 5,000 years ago, early civilizations started to establish divisions of the year and of the day and night. They created calendars so that they could organize communal activities and public events, schedule the shipment of goods, and, most importantly, regulate the cycles of planting and harvesting throughout the year. Early Egyptian inventors created instruments to measure time during the day. They devised sundials, which indicated time by the length or direction of the sun's shadow throughout the hours of daylight. They also created water clocks to measure time at night. One of the first of these clocks was a basin with a small hole near the bottom through which water dripped out. Lines marked on the inner surface of the basin denoted the passing hours. Both of these forms of clocks may have performed satisfactorily around the Mediterranean, but could not be relied upon in the cloudy and often freezing weather of northern Europe. By the 13th century, the wish to have more dependable timekeeping instruments in Europe led to the invention of the mechanical clock. This was welcomed by religious leaders, such as the Bishop of Paris, who wanted a more accurate way of telling the time, as well as by traders, who lived, for the most part, in towns and cities. These early clocks told the time by striking a bell. During that time, skilled craftsmen were building clocks for churches or clock towers in France and Italy, and for several centuries after the invention of the mechanical clock, the regular striking of a bell, which could be heard throughout the surrounding area, was enough to divide up the day for most people. By the 15th century, there was a growing demand for clocks in the home. This led to the invention of a spring to replace the weight used in mechanical clocks. This single invention made it possible to develop portable clocks and was used in timepieces well into the 20th century. In the early days, these clocks were considered a luxury and only the very wealthy could afford them. In the 17th century, a Dutch astronomer named Christian Huygens devised two important improvements to timepieces, the pendulum and the balance spring. The first pendulum clock was about 100 times more accurate than its predecessors, and allowed astronomers to measure the movement of stars with greater precision. The balance spring sparked an almost immediate rise in the market for watches, which were no longer typically hung around the neck, but carried in a pocket.
It also increased the demand for portable sundials by which watches could be set to time. At the start of the 19th century, clocks and watches were relatively accurate, but they remained expensive. In 1807, Eli Terry, an American clockmaker, started to make shelf clocks that were so simple all they needed was to be placed on a level surface and wound up. He also made them using machinery which allowed the components to be mass-produced. This reduced production costs considerably, and he was able to sell his clocks for the relatively modest sum of $15. Many ordinary people were now able to afford a clock. During the 19th century, many clockmakers started to focus on producing watches instead of clocks. They realised that the market for watches would far exceed that for clocks if production costs could be kept down. By the 1870s, these had fallen and productivity levels had improved to such an extent that the watch was at last accessible to almost everyone. Because women wore bracelet watches in the 19th century, wrist watches were considered to be too feminine, so men continued to carry pocket watches. During the First World War, however, they were modified so that they could be worn on the wrist, as it was a more practical place to check the time on the battlefield. After the war, the masculine fashion for wristwatches caught on. The 20th century was marked by the invention of ever more precise timekeepers. Quartz clocks were first developed in the 1920s, followed by atomic clocks in the 1940s, and cesium beam atomic clocks in the 1950s. Today, highly accurate timekeeping instruments control most of our electronic devices. For example, nearly all computers have a crystal quartz clock to regulate operations. Our banking systems and power grids are all controlled by these devices. We have become so dependent on these time-based technologies that it is only when they break down that we realise how vital they are to us.
Now listen a second time and check your answers.
At least 5,000 years ago, early civilizations started to establish divisions of the year and of the day and night. They created calendars so that they could organise communal activities and public events, schedule the shipment of goods, and, most importantly, regulate the cycles of planting and harvesting throughout the year. Early Egyptian inventors created instruments to measure time during the day. They devised sundials, which indicated time by the length or direction of the sun's shadow throughout the hours of daylight. They also created water clocks to measure time at night. One of the first of these clocks was a basin with a small hole near the bottom through which water dripped out. Lines marked on the inner surface of the basin denoted the passing hours. Both of these forms of clocks may have performed satisfactorily around the Mediterranean, but could not be relied upon in the cloudy and often freezing weather of northern Europe. By the 13th century, the wish to have more dependable timekeeping instruments in Europe led to the invention of the mechanical clock. This was welcomed by religious leaders, such as the Bishop of Paris, who wanted a more accurate way of telling the time, as well as by traders who lived, for the most part, in towns and cities. These early clocks told the time by striking a bell. During that time, skilled craftsmen were building clocks for churches or clock towers in France and Italy, and for several centuries after the invention of the mechanical clock, the regular striking of a bell which could be heard throughout the surrounding area was enough to divide up the day for most people. By the 15th century, there was a growing demand for clocks in the home. This led to the invention of a spring to replace the weight used in mechanical clocks. This single invention made it possible to develop portable clocks and was used in timepieces well into the 20th century. In the early days, these clocks were considered a luxury and only the very wealthy could afford them. In the 17th century, a Dutch astronomer named Christian Huygens devised two important improvements to timepieces, the pendulum and the balance spring. The first pendulum clock was about 100 times more accurate than its predecessors and allowed astronomers to measure the movement of stars with greater precision. The balance spring sparked an almost immediate rise in the market for watches, which were no longer typically hung around the neck but carried in a pocket. It also increased the demand for portable sundials by which watches could be set to time. At the start of the 19th century, clocks and watches were relatively accurate, but they remained expensive. In 1807, Eli Terry, an American clockmaker, started to make shelf clocks that were so simple all they needed was to be placed on a level surface and wound up. He also made them using machinery which allowed the components to be mass-produced. This reduced production costs considerably, and he was able to sell his clocks for the relatively modest sum of $15. Many ordinary people were now able to afford a clock. During the 19th century, many clockmakers started to focus on producing watches instead of clocks. They realised that the market for watches would far exceed that for clocks if production costs could be kept down. By the 1870s, these had fallen and productivity levels had improved to such an extent that the watch was at last accessible to almost everyone. Because women wore bracelet watches in the 19th century, wrist watches were considered to be too feminine, so men continued to carry pocket watches. During the First World War, however, they were modified so that they could be worn on the wrist, as it was a more practical place to check the time on the battlefield. After the war, the masculine fashion for wristwatches caught on. The 20th century was marked by the invention of ever more precise timekeepers. Quartz clocks were first developed in the 1920s, followed by atomic clocks in the 1940s, and cesium beam atomic clocks in the 1950s. Today, highly accurate timekeeping instruments control most of our electronic devices. For example, nearly all computers have a crystal quartz clock to regulate operations. Our banking systems and power grids are all controlled by these devices. We have become so dependent on these time-based technologies that it is only when they break down that we realise how vital they are to us.
That's the end of the test. Please wait for your question booklets to be collected. Thank you, and good luck.